Thanks for joining us for today's session, the Operating Reserves Market Review session here. My name is Jennifer Vollmer, and I am a member of the communications team with the stakeholder engagement side. So we're really happy to have you here. We're just going to go through a few slides that you've probably seen before, but just bear with us, and then we'll get things kicked off. So if we can move on to the next slide here. So just a notice on our recording. So we are recording this session, and we will be posting the audio of this recording on our stakeholder engagement page in the days following this session. So if you have any questions or concerns with that, feel free to reach out to the contact information below for our FOIP office, and we'd be happy to answer those questions for you. We can move on to the next slide. So I know we've done this for a few years now, but just a brief refresher on using Zoom. So as we're in a webinar, you guys are, as attendees, are all in the listen mode, and you have your cameras disabled and your microphones muted. So we ask that when you participate and ask questions for this session, that you please first state your first and last name, as well as the organization that you're with, just to make sure that we're attributing comments correctly during the session. Reminder, there are two ways to ask your questions during Q&As. So we have several different Q&A portions following each segment in the session. For that, you're able to raise your hand and we'll be able to see that. We will ask you to unmute, and you'll just unmute on your end, and then you can go ahead and ask your question. You can alternatively type in questions into the Q&A window or box. And other participants are able to upvote those questions. So if there's something, a topic that you're really interested in that you want to hear as a higher priority, you're welcome to upvote those questions, and we will address those in the order in there. You can move on to the next slide. So where to access controls, this is pretty standard. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that, but you're able to, depending on what device you're using, kind of hover over the controls to raise your hand and lower your hand. After you've asked your question, you can just obviously click into the Q&A area and type in your question. When you're using your smartphone, and I'm not sure if we have anyone on the phone lines yet, it doesn't look like we do, but if anyone joins or needs to switch to that, you'll be able to raise your hand on your smartphone there and also lower your hand or type a question in the Q&A box. Next slide, please. So again, I don't think we have anyone on conference call right now, but if anyone needs to switch formats, you can press *9 on your keypad to raise your hand. And the setting for muting and unmuting is *6 to be able to ask your question. Same for phone controls for attendees. So pretty simple and straightforward there. And I think that's it. So if you have any questions or issues, you know, you can always send us a quick email if there's any tech difficulties, and we'll try and support you as needed. But I think we're going to jump into the session now. So I'd like to hand it over to Miranda Erickson, our Vice President of Markets.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Very smooth as always. I won't join you for too long this morning, but I wanted to take the opportunity. And for those of you who I don't know, and it's always hard for me to tell on these Zoom, it's not like you're all in a room and I can look around for familiar or unfamiliar faces. I'm Miranda Keating Erickson. I'm the Vice President of Markets here at the ISO. And I want to thank you all for joining us this morning, and I hope you all had a good summer. It certainly felt like that summer is coming to an end when I got out of bed this morning. So here we are into the fall and into some busy time, as September always is. I want to do a little bit of context setting for us today and remind us all why we're here and how we got to this point where we are today. Some of you may recall in 2019, so pre-COVID, sort of the 2.5 lost years that we seem to have had, the ISO had been asked to do an assessment and prepare a report for government regarding market power and market power mitigation. The minister accepted our advice in that report that the current market power mitigation framework that was embedded in our energy and operating reserves markets were expected to remain efficient and effective. We concluded through that work that no policy changes were required, and that if future changes were needed, they could be made within the current legislative and regulatory structure. Specifically, though, in that report, the conclusions regarding the OR market had indicated that some changes to the OR markets may be helpful to support and increase competition, such as facilitating entry by additional qualified resources and improving competition within the existing OR products and market. The report, remember this is 2019, stated that the ISO was evaluating options for such changes. So that all brings us to the work that we've been doing and this discussion today to assess opportunities to enhance competition and price fidelity in the existing OR markets to improve efficiency. I want to reiterate, I know we've said this more than once, that the OR market is functioning. But we do remain of the view that there are opportunities to increase competitiveness and price fidelity to improve efficiency in these markets. We continue to believe that it's important to remove barriers to entry and to facilitate entry by additional qualified resources and improve competition within the OR products and market. We remain of the view that it's important to explore this now and progress incremental changes within the current design to support competition and efficiency in the current market for current products. So we've kept the scope of this entire engagement quite narrow, very focused to where changes could be impactful, but also implementable in the short term. And this is because as we are undergoing a significant transformation on our electricity grid, we anticipate there may be bigger changes coming in the future. Pursuing these changes now, these incremental changes, will help us as we look to evaluate the need for either new products or larger changes over the coming year, because it will give us confidence that we've optimized the existing market and have it functioning as well as it can. In the context of that significant transformation that lays ahead, we also understand that there are many activities underway across the industry, and lots of those are very high priority. As you heard from us recently, we presented some of the reliability challenges on the grid today in our Sustaining Reliability Through Transformation session. I suspect many of you were in attendance at that. And so as the grid changes, questions about how our ancillary service products could be future solutions will be considered through those initiatives. So that's not what we're here talking about today. We will be presenting some design recommendations today, some of them finalized, some of them still seeking some further input from you. Some of those recommendations or decisions may require ISO rule changes. On the other hand, some may require contract changes or simply process changes. But no matter the process for effecting any change that we choose to implement, the ISO values the importance of stakeholder consultation and input, and we've included all items, no matter what that change process is for them, in this consultation so that we can look at things holistically, promote transparency, stability, and ensure that all of you have a comprehensive understanding of the changes we may be contemplating. We've said right from the beginning that any decisions on proposed changes would be evaluated with your input, both in terms of whether to make any particular changes and in terms of the priority and pace of any implementation. As such, your feedback continues to be very important to me and to the ISO. Leaving our session today, participants should have a strong sense of where some of these design changes are landing and the few areas where we're continuing to seek some feedback before we move to decisions. And with that, I'm going to leave you to your session today, and I'm going to hand things over to Rupa.
Thanks, Miranda. If we can move on to the next slide. So I first want to thank everybody for taking the time to join us today. I know there's a lot on the go, and we, as Miranda mentioned, we value stakeholder input and feedback through these processes and initiatives. Just working through the agenda, so in today's session, we will be building upon the topics introduced and covered in sessions 1 and 2. For some of these topics, the ISO has developed recommendations. considering stakeholder feedback from the previous sessions, and some require further input. Moving on to the next slide. You've already heard from Miranda, our VP of Markets, earlier this morning. I am Rupa Luisa, manager in the Markets team. Brendan Jewett, also from the Markets team, will be going over the bulk of the presentation today. From our Grid and Reliability team, we have Dan Weeb, manager of the Ops Engineering and Market Support team. We also have some members of the Legal and Regulatory Affairs team joining us today as well. Next slide. So just going over the initiative summary. As Miranda mentioned earlier this morning, the purpose of this initiative is to assess opportunities to enhance competition and price fidelity in the existing OR markets to improve efficiency. At the highest level, the market is functioning. But there are several design elements that are not performing in the way that promotes efficiency. Therefore, we think that incremental change that support an efficient market design should be sufficient to address those concerns, which means taking a focused and narrow scope to where changes are impactful and implementable in the short term. Slide 10. So we'll go through a little bit of the initiative process. So this is the third session for this initiative. As we mentioned before, we value stakeholder input and have considered this feedback to develop the recommendations being presented today and to inform the topics that require further input. Stakeholder feedback following this session will be due on September 30th. For those topics that require rule changes, we will initiate rule consultation in Q4 2022 and then file in Q1 2023. And then implementation on the recommendations will be throughout 2022-2023. Next slide. So our objectives of this session are to share final recommendations based on the draft recommendations shared in session two, to share and discuss the ISO's draft recommendations on hourly procurement, standby pricing, and a small number of supporting design decisions, and to provide an update on the timing and format for the remainder of the engagement. Next slide. Next slide. And next slide. So before we get into the design recommendations, I wanted to provide context on the status of each of the topics. So some parts of the design recommendation decisions may require ISO rule changes, as Miranda mentioned earlier. And while on the other hand, some may only require contractor process changes. As we've mentioned a couple times already, we value the importance of stakeholder consultation, and stakeholder input has been considered on all items to promote transparency, stability, and to ensure that stakeholders have a comprehensive understanding of all the changes considered in this initiative. Where you see final decisions, they do not require rule changes, but they may be process or contract changes. Final recommendations outlined in this initiative and throughout the topics do require rule changes. And then there are some topics that require further stakeholder input on either an identified preferred alternative or input on options to determine a preferred alternative. So Brendan Jewett will go through the bulk of the presentation here, and through each of the topics, we will stop after each topic for Q&A. So I will now pass it over to Brendan to go through the design topics in further detail. Brendan?
Thanks, Rupa. So the categories of the design elements that we're looking at today should be familiar to those participants that have been part of this consultation so far. And Jen mentioned it at the beginning, but I'll just mention again that we do have a discussion Q&A period after each topic. So we're happy to take your questions and comments at those times. So I'll begin with equilibrium pricing and the ISO bid price. So just a quick refresher on the current practice and our proposed alternative. So currently in the active OR markets, we set what's called the equilibrium price, which is determined by averaging the marginal offer price and the ISO bid price. The ISO bid prices are not visible to parties that are not actively participating in the WADEX platform. And the ISO bid price acts as an offer cap to participants. And then dispatched active reserve providers are paid the energy pool price plus the equilibrium price. Or in other words, the equilibrium price is indexed to the energy pool price. The ISO's proposed alternatives are to remove the equilibrium pricing methodology and instead move to a marginal pricing methodology where we will set the uniform price at the marginal offer price. The index to the energy pool price would remain. And then we want to increase transparency and review and publicly disclose the ISO bid price. So relating to our first proposed alternative of marginal pricing, some stakeholders were supportive of this in their feedback. Some stakeholders were indifferent, and we had a few who expressed concerns. Primarily, the concerns about moving to marginal pricing centered around increased volatility in the market. So just a few comments on that topic. Firstly, we want to remind participants that the price floor for operating reserves is $0 per megawatt hour, regardless of where the price index settles. So even if we do see a substantially negative equilibrium price, we will never have a price for operating reserves below zero after it's been indexed to the energy pool price. And participants are able to manage their exposure to low prices through their offer behavior in the OR markets. We also want to point out that volatility is not necessarily undesirable if it's reflective of the competitive market conditions, and that strong price signals are important in order for participants to respond and be able to observe the conditions of the operating reserve market. We also received analysis from one stakeholder of revenues for operating reserves under the marginal pricing format while holding offer behavior constant. So in other words, just undoing the averaging that the equilibrium pricing methodology applies. And so we think that this is a helpful comparison, and it's good to take a look at those bookend scenarios. However, we do expect that participants will adjust their offer behavior to account for the removal of equilibrium pricing and moving to a marginal pricing methodology. And to the extent that we do observe that some participants do not change their offer behavior, so that it does change prices and ultimately revenues for operating reserves, we think that that indicates that equilibrium pricing was having an influence on market outcomes away from the competitive outcome. So given what we've heard from stakeholders, as well as our own rationale, the decision is to move to marginal pricing, or in other words, to remove equilibrium pricing and to set the uniform price for operating reserves at the marginal offer price. We believe that marginal pricing, like it does in our energy market, produces accurate price signals that reflect the competitive outcome in the market. So moving on from marginal pricing, the other part of this design element is the ISO bid price. So to begin, we'd like to share ISO bid prices for those participants that perhaps do not actively participate in the OR market today and may not be aware of the ISO's current bid prices. So I'll just very quickly review these. So for regulating reserves, we have four time blocks that we procure. For the AM super peak period, we have an ISO bid price of $100 per megawatt hour. For the PM super peak period, $30 per megawatt hour. For the on-peak period, $40 per megawatt hour. And for the off-peak period, $100 per megawatt hour. For spinning reserves that we procure in both on-peak and off-peak blocks, the ISO bid price is $40 per megawatt hour for both blocks. And for supplemental reserves, for the on-peak block, The ISO bid price is also $40 per megawatt hour. And for the off-peak block, the ISO bid price is $5 per megawatt hour. So as part of this assessment, the ISO wants to ensure that the bid prices are reflecting the relative value of the OR products compared to each other. And so we think that there's currently a mismatch between the value of regulating reserve compared to some contingency reserve products and the ISO bid prices respectively. So on slide 19, one of the pieces of analysis that we used in order to assess the appropriateness of the ISO bid prices was looking at price duration curves to assess how prices have formed under the current bid prices. We looked at data from the beginning of 2020 through March 31st, 2022. And we used these duration curves to evaluate the frequency of high prices and assess whether current OR bid prices are restricting competitive outcomes. We do want to note that this isn't a complete analysis on its own. It's just one part of a broader framework, because if we did observe stickiness up against the OR bid prices, that could be the result of restricted competitive outcomes, or it could be the result of an increase in market power pushing up those prices. However, what we observe in the market is that prices that are at or near the ISO bid price are currently rare. And for all products and time blocks, the price reached the ISO bid price under 1% of the time. Beginning on slide 20, we have a series of figures showing these duration curves. I won't talk through all of them in detail, but just a couple high-level notes. Firstly, we've zoomed in these duration curves to show the top 10% of prices. That's because, as I mentioned, these high prices up against the ISO bid prices are relatively infrequent. And so when we look at the super peak product for regulating reserves, we see there's a relatively linear trend. However, the prices, as I mentioned, are actually hitting the peak of the ISO bid price in less than 1% of the time. Looking at spinning reserves, or pardon me, looking at the on and off peak blocks for regulating reserves, again, we see a similar trend where the prices are somewhat linear in that top 10 percentile and very low stickiness up against the ISO bid price. Looking at the on and off peak prices for spinning reserves, we can see that high prices in general are less frequent for these products. And we see a very narrow tail where the spinning reserve products start to approach the ISO bid price. We can see for the spinning reserve product, for example, we don't even see the $40 ISO bid price on the duration curve in this figure. And finally, for supplemental reserves, similarly, we see very low pressure up against the ISO bid price with very few instances and certainly less than 1% of the time for both on and off peak time blocks. Another metric that we used to assess the performance of the ISO bid prices was to see how investment in new OR capability has occurred through time under the current ISO bid prices. And so this figure shows that there have been steady additions of OR qualified capacity going back to 2018. We do see a spike in 2020. However, we think that's to be expected as investment in OR capability is inherently lumpy and comes in stages. And so we do conclude from the from this analysis that there has been steady volume under the current bid prices, and they've been able to attract investment in new capability. Another indicator we used was looking at other jurisdictions and the way that operating reserves are priced in those jurisdictions. The primary takeaway that we had from this review is that operating reserves are inherently priced using a different mechanism or a different framework in most other jurisdictions to what we use in Alberta. So typically other jurisdictions will use a complex, often co-optimized algorithm for their dispatch of both energy and operating reserves. And the prices for operating reserves are typically an output from that process that are based on things like the opportunity cost for energy, as well as applying penalty factors for things like reserve shortages and locational constraints. That being said, we've briefly summarized the findings from a few jurisdictions on this slide here, and we want to particularly draw attention to SPP, or the Southwest Power Pool, because their pricing structure for reserves most closely resembles our own, and that they have separate caps for regulating and contingency reserves. The caps for those products are $500 for regulating reserves, $100 for contingency reserves, and then $1,000 for energy. Those are the offer caps. And then the price caps that come out of those offer caps end up as $1,100 per megawatt hour for reserves, which is the sum of both the energy offer cap and the contingency reserve offer cap. We also wanted to assess the potential for cost under the current ISO bid prices. And so to do that, the ISO used a representative study of cycling costs over the shortest time period block for each reserve product. That means that we used the 3-hour duration of the AM superpeak product for regulating reserves and the 8-hour duration of the off-peak block for contingency reserves. The asset characteristics that we used for this study were for a reference unit aeroderivative simple cycle unit that, if participants are interested in more detail of the characteristics of that unit, they can find it at the linked study in this slide. We chose this asset both because it's flexible enough to cycle to provide reserves, and also because the costs that it incurs are more explicit and easily measured compared to some other assets that may be well-suited reserves. Some more of the input assumptions we used included the July 2022 monthly natural gas price index of $6.83 per gigajoule, a carbon price of $50 per ton, and we assumed that the pool price was $0 per megawatt hour, so that all cost recovery was coming from the operating reserve market in these scenarios. The analysis showed that recovery of cycling costs for regulating reserves could occur at a price of $121 per megawatt hour, and for contingency reserves at a price of $45 per megawatt hour. So some summary conclusions from the various things that we looked at in assessing the ISO bid prices. Firstly, we believe that the current ISO bid prices do not all reflect the relative value of the different OR products. We also observed that historical market outcomes are suggesting that the current ISO bid prices are not restricting competitive outcomes. We've also seen that the current ISO bid prices have been sufficient to attract new competition and new investment in recent years. While other jurisdictions have minimal applicability due to their fundamentally different co-optimized frameworks, we do think that the Southwest Power Pool price cap of $1,100 per megawatt hour is a good reference point. And the cycling cost analysis suggests that the current ISO bid prices do not always provide the opportunity for cost recovery, especially in circumstances when the pool price is very low. Based on that rationale, the ISO's recommendation for the bid prices is to set the ISO bid price to $150 per megawatt hour for all regulating reserve blocks and $50 per megawatt hour for all spinning reserve and supplemental blocks. For comparison purposes to some of the other price caps in that jurisdiction review, this results in effective price caps of $1,150 per megawatt hour for regulating reserves and $1,050 per megawatt hour for contingency reserves after including the maximum potential energy price that could be combined with the operating reserve price. We think that setting the bid price the same for all time blocks of each product allows the competitive market to establish the price differential that's warranted between time blocks. And the ISO will also be making these ISO bid prices transparent by reporting them through a report on the Energy Trading System, or ETS. So in summary, the current practice of equilibrium pricing by averaging the marginal offer and the ISO bid price. The ISO's proposed alternative is to move to marginal pricing by removing equilibrium pricing and setting the uniform price at the marginal offer price. And that is a decision, a final decision. And the ISO bid prices that we listed on slide 18, we would like to move to a $150 per megawatt hour ISO bid price for regulating reserves and a $50 per megawatt hour ISO bid price for the contingency reserves or spinning reserves and supplemental reserves. And the ISO would like to publish the ISO bid prices through the ETS platform. And that is a draft recommendation at this stage. With that, we are happy to take any questions or comments and discuss further.
Thanks, Brennan. Let's jump into some Q&A here. So I'm going to go over to the raised hands first. So Horst, I see you there. I'm just going to unmute you on my end. If you can unmute yourself as well.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. So it's Horst Klinkenborg with Suncor. And so I don't have a comment on the first part, the removal of the equilibrium pricing, but I do think that there's a couple of questions being raised by the presentation regarding the bid price. First of all, I think the analysis does not show what the ISO just shared it would show, because I think the bid price does restrict competitive outcomes. Every time you reach the bid price means the ISO bid basically limited where prices would normally clear in the market. That might only occur like less than 1% of the time, but that's really more an indication as to how competitive the OR market already is, which brings into question this entire exercise of do we really need to spend this time and effort and make all these tweaks and changes to make the market more competitive when we've already established that it is competitive, like so competitive more than 99% of the time, that even an artificial price cap is not impacting price outcomes. Competition is already limiting prices. So I think it's a completely different conclusion coming out of those charts, and that is the market is competitive, it is working, and yes, the ISO's bid price is limiting competition in very few hours, but that's a function of the competitiveness of the market, not that the bid price isn't distorting outcomes. And then regarding the analysis of cost recovery, I think it has no business at all in this kind of analysis, because we're not in a market where we're looking at like capping offers or behavior tied to kind of cost recovery or anything like that. This is a free and open market, and we're not here to just say, oh, here, we put a cap there, so that's just enough that you can get cost recovery. It's like not anything we're doing in this market, and I think has no business in the market, and I don't want any precedent that we're using this kind of analysis to set prices. And that gets me back to comments we've made in the previous session, probably in the previous two sessions, which I don't think have been addressed, in that the ISO must procure OR, and so I don't see how there's actually any good rationale for a low price cap to begin with, because ultimately, if the ISO through their price cap limits the procurement of OR, it would then have to go out and conscript OR. And it can't be that you're not willing to pay enough and then you can go out and just get it through other means. So there's some disconnect there. So I think there's maybe a discussion around market power, but this is completely missing from this discussion. So I would say the entire piece around price cap should be removed, and we should talk about a very high kind of market power limiting type of offer cap for suppliers, just like we have in the energy market. And so, yeah, I'm pretty disappointed that we have this section here and this discussion. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments, Horst. I think there was a lot in there, certainly. So I think I'll just respond to a couple parts of that. And if there's more that you would like me to respond to, I think I'm happy to have a follow-up from you. Firstly, I think you mentioned that cost recovery shouldn't be a consideration in the setting of the ISO bid price. Firstly, I'll mention that that analysis was done in part in response to a stakeholder feedback asking us to look at that as part of our determination. And secondly, that it only makes up one part of a broader assessment of the appropriateness of the ISO bid prices. And I would also say that while we have observed that competition is sufficient to prevent persistent prices up against the current ISO bid prices, that doesn't necessarily indicate that competition is as strong as it can be, just that it's not so weak that the prices are continually up against the ISO bid price. And so we do think that there's the opportunity to raise the bid prices from what they are today, but several of the indicators suggest that the bid prices are functioning today.
Perfect. I guess the following up question would be, what do you mean by functioning? So yes, they are capping the market. That's absolutely what they're doing, and they have been doing. But with what justifications, and why at such a low level? I mean, the ISO has to literally procure operating reserves to meet its WECC requirements. And so in a way, they are a captive buyer. There are market power concerns, but this is not a market power analysis. Like, none of that is. So it's like this analysis kind of completely missing the point of a potential price cap for the OR market.
I think if we define market power as being prices above marginal cost, I think that the cost recovery assessment does become at least one input that can be used in considering the market power in the market, and that if the bid prices are sufficient for cost recovery in what we believe is a bookend scenario where assets are cycling only to provide reserves, the pool price is $0, and those participants are relying solely on the OR market for their cost recovery. We don't think that that represents the typical scenario in the OR market, but rather a scenario that can occur. And so we think that if the market is structured so that it can provide cost recovery in those bookend scenarios, it means that in the more typical market outcomes, that there's a range of flexibility for participants to adjust or accommodate different offer strategies.
Thank you, Brendan. Okay, so I'm just going to hop over to one of the written Q&As here. We have a question from Ethan. I'm sorry, I'm not going to attempt the Hanashin. Sorry if that's not right. His question is, would it produce increased reliability when determining the ISO ancillary price cap to consider what is the value of the service to the ISO/system operators and ultimately the consumers? It seems all analysis has been performed under the perspective of what is the cost of providing the service. He notes further, these costs are being calculated with respect to 2022 carbon and natural gas market conditions. While this implementation process may not be effective until sometime in the increasingly uncertain future. Anyone like to jump in on that one?
Sure. I think there's two parts to that. The first is the supply side centric analysis. And I think that's certainly a good, fair comment. I think something like a value of loss load study is something that we did hear participant feedback about and something that we did consider doing. However, the reality is that a vol study, both logistically and practically, has some complications associated with it, including the relatively high cost of performing a study like that, and also that vol is not a sort of cut and dry metric in that it varies highly between different types of participants and at different times. And the way that operating reserves contribute to reducing instances of load shed or to vol, also there's some nuance into that relationship. And so while we agree that you could take that approach in determining the ISO bid prices and that there may be value to that, we think that the indicators that we've looked at suggest that the ISO bid prices are working today, but that there is the opportunity to increase them somewhat to account for some cost recovery. On that note, you also mentioned our use of 2022 assumptions, and we agree that that may change going forward. And that's part of why we think it's important to have the flexibility to be able to adjust the bid prices in response to market conditions. For example, if cost fundamentals change going into the future, we would retain the flexibility to make adjustments to reflect that.
Wonderful. Thank you, Brandon. Okay, on to our next question from Randy Stubbings. His question is, why is the ISO bid price still relevant under the new pricing mechanism?
So the ISO bid price effectively acts only as an offer cap under a marginal pricing scenario because it would no longer be used in an averaging formula to determine the equilibrium price.
Okay, thank you. One here from Megan Gill. Will the ISO be publishing its analysis from slide 26 for stakeholders to review in more detail before we provide feedback on the price cap?
I think our intent is not to publish it at this point. I think we've published the assumptions that we used, and if stakeholders are interested in critiquing the assumptions on the reference unit, the gas price, anything like that, I think we're open to that. If stakeholders do feel that publishing that analysis would be valuable, then I think we're open to hearing that feedback as well.
That's great. Thank you very much. Just hop back over here.
Sorry, Jen, just maybe one thing to add to that question as well. We did consider publishing the analysis earlier, but some of the inputs that are used are confidential because they're used in some of our modeling internally that's not disclosed publicly. And so if participants do feel strongly that they'd like to see a published version of that, I think there may be the capability for us to redact some of that information and publish it in that way. But that's something that we'd have to determine based on what we hear from stakeholders.
Great. Excellent follow-up. Thank you for that. So I am just going to check here. One second. We're going to go back to raised hands here. I see Akira has a raised hand. If you want to unmute. Oh, looks like you lowered. Back. Okay, I'm going to unmute you on your end if you want to ask your question. Thank you, Akira.
Thank you, Akira Yamamoto from TransAlta. My question isn't specific to the equilibrium pricing or ISO bid price recommendation. I have the comments that are inside the Q&A that speak more closely to that. It's more about the decision-making process. So I am surprised that we're at this stage already. I don't think that it was clarified what this decision-making and governance process was. And I'm staggered that we're at this point where you're at a point where you believe that you finalized your decision and consider the stakeholder feedback. I think it's even more problematic when you come back and you say that you're not willing to share certain information with us that underpins some of your analysis that are going into this. When you're making a final decision on your own and there is no regulatory process upon which stakeholders have an opportunity to ask that information for that information and not and have that adjudicated through the AUC. I think this is troubling at best, and I wish that this was fully explained up front, but I do think that you have presumptively and preemptively shifted to final decisions with a lot of promises that additional analysis on cost and benefit for all these things and better justification was going to be provided. And yet we're at the stage where you finalized your decisions and you provided none of that to the stakeholders during the consultation sessions. These are more comments and not necessarily expecting a response, but if you'd like to, go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Akira, for your thoughts. Throughout this consultation, so I think like there were, as I mentioned it kind of in the intro, there are sections that require rule changes, which will go through the AUC rule change process. There are aspects of these changes that are process changes or relate back to the contract governing the OR procurement. And so regardless of which change it was, we think that the same amount of rigor is required from a stakeholder consultation perspective. And so, which is why we've kind of bundled them together throughout this consultation so that stakeholders have a comprehensive overview of how all the changes are interdependent and how they impact each other. We also think, as we mentioned a few times already, that stakeholder input is important. And I think potentially one of the reasons you may be bringing this up is more related to the transparency section, which Brendan will talk to in the next section.
It isn't actually specific to that. It's specific to all these decisions that you're making at this point in time. I find it quite troubling that since you've engaged in this operating reserves market review, you've proposed naked solutions without proper justification of what they're trying to achieve or what the benefits truly are, other than qualitative discussion and the suggestion that you can always improve things. I think that you've underestimated the risk that your improvements actually create bigger issues in the market. And I think those are the points that have been highlighted by many stakeholders during these sessions, and we've seen no acknowledgement of that. In fact, you have done very little to amend any of the initial recommendations that you proposed, despite the fact that stakeholders have opposed them.
Your opinion is noted. And I think as we work through some of the recommendations, you'll see where we have taken into consideration stakeholder feedback and the rationale supporting our decision-making process. From a governance perspective, I think there was a response in the chat already for those decisions that do not require rules. And so, you know, we've got internal processes to support that. But again, your opinion is noted.
What does the process look like after this? If there's consistent disagreement and what does need to be escalated, what does that process look like? I've not encountered this in the past where the ISO pursues something unilaterally without essentially just requiring an EVP's sign off at the ISO to do that.
So Akira, maybe we'll just jump to, I'll have Brendan go through the transparency section, but I'll give you an example. So TransAlta submitted a report regarding sealed bid and transparency, which is published on our website. We had outlined that as a final decision. And we are now going to present the rationale on why we support that final decision. However, what we will do now is just take a pause and take the time to review the report that you have submitted and have stakeholders provide input on the report, like take into consideration the report as well in their stakeholder comments following the session. So I think like that's part of that's an example of us going through the stakeholder process. And like I said, we'll go through that in the next section, but, you know, we're trying to look at all this stuff holistically. But again, your comments are noted and I will move to Brendan to move to the next section.
Thanks, Rupa. Okay. So I think, we're going to continue moving on into the next content here. We're good with that. Brendan, if you want to take it away then. Thank you.
Thanks. So Rupa mentioned this in her response there, but just to reiterate that, the ISO did recently receive a report from TransAlta, an expert report, pardon me, to supplement their comments on this next topic. And so we will be thoroughly considering that new information and use it to review the conclusions and the decisions that are presented in this section. In today's session, we're still going to present the material that was posted on August 30th, and that's so that stakeholders can understand the rationale that led us to our initial findings. However, those findings are subject to change pending further review of that new report. So just to begin, on the topic of offer transparency, the current practice is that offers to the WADEX platform are visible to all participants once they've been submitted into the platform. However, that does not include offer party attribution. And 60-day lagged offer information is somewhat available through ETS as it includes the clearing price, not the offer price. And it includes the asset and the participant attribution, and it shows only cleared volumes, not volumes that did not clear the market. The ISO's proposed alternative is to move to a sealed bid format for operating reserves that to align with the energy market, and also to align OR offer disclosure with the energy offer disclosure that's stipulated by the FEOC regulation. And in doing so, we would publish the offer price, volume, and offer control party of all offers with a 60-day leg, not just those offers that clear the market. And we believe that that would align the state of the OR market with the energy market by reducing real-time transparency, but increasing ex post transparency in order to facilitate an information-rich market. In the previous session, in session two, the ISO shared a high-level description of the benefits and the risks of open versus sealed auctions. And we did receive from some participants feedback that emphasized the potential benefits of open auctions. And so in response and in considering that feedback, the ISO conducted a more comprehensive survey of available peer-reviewed literature as well as expert reports. Some participants also asked for more empirical analysis of the OR market. And the ISO has not undertaken an empirical analysis of transparency in the OR market for a few reasons. Firstly, there's no natural experiment in the OR market, which means that we can't observe the state of the market with and without transparency in order to perform some sort of empirical analysis that way. And as a result, it would be very challenging to reliably distinguish the positive and negative effects of transparency from all the other factors that we know impact market conditions and outcomes. For those stakeholders, their information on the benefits and risks of transparency, they may wish to refer to the following report that was prepared for the MSA, which is one part of the evidence that the ISO reviewed in its process. The report is focused on the Alberta energy market. And as we've heard from stakeholders, there are unique characteristics in the OR market that makes it different from the energy market. And those need to be considered when interpreting its findings. For example, the energy market is already a sealed format, which means that the comparison between an open and sealed format was not contemplated in the report. There's also generally less information that's available outside the trading platform for OR than for energy. So there is more information that gives a better indication of energy market conditions than OR market conditions. And the OR market is smaller than the energy market, and participation in OR is voluntary. There are a series of indicators used by the Competition Bureau to assess the potential for lessened competition within a market. And so we want to compare the OR market relative to the energy market against these indicators. For example, with high market concentration, we compared the OR concentration that was shared in the previous session with the energy market concentration that's shared in the MSA's market share offer control report. And based on those numbers, the OR market has a higher concentration than the energy market. Another characteristic is frequent transactions, and the energy market is more frequent than the OR market, as the energy does transact hourly. However, we do still believe that interaction in the OR market is repeated and frequent. The next characteristic is the homogeneity of products, or in other words, the lack of product differentiation. So the OR and energy markets are both homogeneous, as the markets do not differentiate between suppliers. Or in other words, we do not distinguish between qualified volumes of one supplier versus another in procuring OR through the OR market. The next characteristic is predictable demand and similar cost structures between market participants. So the ISO procures a fixed volume that's determined by reliability standards, and we do provide a 7-day forecast of that volume. And we have similar factors that influence both the opportunity cost of providing OR and the direct cost of energy for many participants. And finally, relating to transparency, the OR market is more directly transparent as it uses an open format, while the energy market generally has more information that's available outside of the trading platform. Looking at these indicators, they suggest that the characteristics of the energy market and the OR market mean that the risks of lessened competition are at least equal in the OR market as they are in the energy market, or perhaps greater in the OR market. As stakeholders have noted, though, there are many benefits of having open transparency, and those include reduced risk and uncertainty for market participants that can ultimately reduce costs, and also reduced information asymmetries between different types of participants. And so the ISO has considered how different forms of disclosure of information in the OR market can still promote and achieve those benefits while reducing risks. With respect to transparency in the long term and the medium term, we think that long-term transparency is vital in order to send signals for investment and new capability, and that we can continue to provide long-term transparency through comprehensive price reporting, and that we can enhance long-term transparency by disclosing full offer curves with offer prices instead of just the clearing prices and cleared offers that we disclose today. Within the medium term, or in other words, transparency that may be an indicator of market conditions rather in the coming days, we think that there are reports that we publish through ETS that do provide some indication of what conditions may be like in the OR market in the multi-day timeframe. Those include the daily active and standby operating reserve price reports, the 7-day OR volume forecast, the daily outage report, the 7-day hourly available capability, the supply adequacy report, and potentially others as well. And then relating to the primary consideration here, which is short-term transparency, or in other words, transparency within the day-ahead market. A few considerations related to that. Firstly, currently only qualified providers that are already actively engaged with the WADEX platform benefit from that short-term transparency. So sometimes open transparency is suggested that it will bring other providers to the market that wouldn't otherwise be participating. However, we believe that you already need to be participating in order to benefit from the current format of transparency. Next, while sophisticated participants can learn from offers that are submitted early in the auction, there are substantial volumes that are submitted late enough that it's not possible to initiate a competitive response within that procurement of that product. So we do believe that to some extent, the current format does not perfectly remove information asymmetries, as those asymmetries may not be revealed until the end of a procurement. We also believe that we can continue to promote or reduce uncertainty about supply conditions, by publishing the cumulative offer volume, or in other words, allowing participants to continue to observe the total volume that's been submitted into the procurement in real time. And I will discuss that more in the next slide. Next, I still have some points to make on this slide. Thank you. So on slide 37, one benefit of greater transparency in real time is the potential for increased demand response or better efficiency of demand response. However, demand response in the OR market is not possible as the ISO procures a fixed volume that's set based on our reliability standards. And we also heard when we consulted on the implementation of standing offers that participants were clear that submitting offers is not a burdensome process. So we think the risk of a participant deciding to not submit offers because it is too burdensome in the presence of a sealed bid format is at least partially mitigated with that information. And so the ISO concluded that the potential risks of an open auction format outweigh the potential benefits in light of these other mechanisms that we believe can sufficiently promote transparency in the market. So offer transparency. This is the decision that we posted in our slides on August 30th, but to reiterate again, we will be reviewing these decisions with the updated information from the expert report that was provided to us. And so the decision was to move to a sealed bid format. The price and volume of the ISO bid would continue to be visible in the auction in real time. On the previous slide, I mentioned that we would continue to make the cumulative offer volume visible. And so again, that would mean that in real time in the auction, participants would be able to see the total amount of supply that was currently offered into the market in order to assess supply conditions. And that suggestion was in response to some participants that suggested that an indicator of supply conditions in real time would be valuable under a sealed bid format. And the clearing price and volume will continue to be visible in WADEX immediately at the auction close in order to promote price discovery moving into subsequent auctions. And they will be available through ETS daily to individuals that do not actively participate in the WADEX platform. So to summarize, the current practice of offers being visible to all participants as soon as they have been submitted. Our proposed alternative is to move to a sealed bid format while continuing to publish the ISO bid price and volume and the cumulative offer volume in real time and making the clearing price and volume visible to participants immediately at auction close. And that's a decision that we'll be reviewing with the new information provided by the expert report. 60-day lagged offer information currently is only available for cleared volumes only, and with the clearing price and asset and participant attribution. And so the proposed alternative is to publish that information with a full merit order that includes offer price for all offered volumes. That is also a decision that we will be reviewing with the new information provided by the expert report. Pardon me. Next, there were a couple questions from session two that we asked participants about the details of how marginal offers may clear the market. Firstly, was whether marginal offers may be partially cleared. We heard from some participants that the ability to opt out of partial clearing, or in other words, have their offer block either accepted in its entirety or not accepted at all, may facilitate greater participation from them. The mechanics of how this would work is that if such an offer that has opted out of partial clearing is the marginal offer and the full volume is not required, then that offer will be skipped. At this stage, that's a draft recommendation that we proceed with that capability. Some participants highlighted in their comments that they were concerned how this may impact the market, or that this may be used for other purposes rather than operational purposes. The ISO considered this and has little concern with that at this time, but we're open to more feedback, or if participants can provide specific examples of how this might be used to manipulate the market. And the final decision item related to transparency is the tie break for equal price marginal offers. Currently, that's based on the earliest submission time. So the earlier offer will take precedence over later submitted offers. After reviewing stakeholder feedback, some participants suggested that a pro rata clearing would be more fair. And so the draft recommendation at this point is to clear equal priced marginal offers on a pro rata basis. Because the OR market does not clear partial megawatts, that can potentially result in situations where the pro rata division of the needed offer volume is not unique, meaning that there may be a small number of megawatts that need to be allocated, but there are more marginal participants than the number of megawatts that need to be allocated. In those cases, or in other words, as a secondary tie break to the pro rata mechanism, we would propose to continue breaking those ties based on earliest submission time. But just to be clear, that secondary tie break would only ever break a tie of at most 1 megawatt, or would only result in at most 1 megawatt being different between marginal offers. So given that that was not a recommendation that we shared in session two, we're still seeking further feedback from participants on that clearing mechanism. With that, we will open for more potential discussion and Q&A again.
Perfect. Thank you, Brendan. Just going to jump over here into our raised hands. I have Parag Menon. If you can unmute on your side, you can go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. This is Parag Menon from Heartland Generation. So the question comes to slide 39, and talking especially on the marginal offer, maybe partially cleared. So you have a recommendation that if in case the participant opts not to participate, so how would it work in terms of the mechanism? Like, would the participant have an option like right away to say no, or would it be post the market close? And then if in case they opt not to get cleared, then would the next on the curve, will they get the volume, and when will they know that, oh, their volume is now cleared because the other marginal participant kind of opted out from the market?
So the participant would opt out of this partial clearing as they submit their offer. Mm-hmm. So I think if I understood you were contemplating a scenario where a participant might view whether or not they were marginal and then decide whether or not to be partially cleared. And so I don't think that's quite the way that we envision this from a mechanical standpoint. Instead, the participant would be able to designate their offer block as being inflexible as they submit it. And then if that offer block ended up being marginal in the procurement, it would be skipped. And so the next block in the merit order would, we would go to that block in order to clear the market. And so all participants would know their clearing position when the market closes.
Okay, thank you, Brendan. Let's see here. We've got Horst with his hand raised just again here. I'm just going to unmute you, Horst, if you can do the same on your end.
Thank you, Horst Klingwerk with Suncor again. First, I wanted to kind of add on to what Akira said earlier on. I'm in the same boat thinking that this is not really what I would call an effective stakeholder consultation, because after session two, there was like 50 to 100 pages of stakeholder comments, and I don't feel that they have properly been addressed. And to see now final decisions in this matrix is, I would say, questionable. But specifically with regard to the decisions on slide 39, I've seen a lot of information and a lot of compelling information regarding to moving to a sealed bid format. So I can maybe even get behind a final decision. I would have maybe called it a recommendation still, or final recommendation. But that jump with regard to the 60-day lagged offer information, I honestly have seen, from my perspective, not really anything justifying that. Despite the recognition that the energy market has more real-time information than the OR market, that aligning the blind bid format also requires us to align to going to a 60-day full disclosure with nothing in between. So I think that entire piece, there's basically been no consultation. And I mean, we've provided comments that the offer stack without names should be available after close. We're in favor of the blind, of the sealed bid format, but this whole how much disclosure you have in between the actual offer or the close of the market and 60 days later, I see nothing substantive here in this presentation, and I don't think there's actually been any substantive consultation or solid justification for that. So I think this should at best be a draft recommendation, let alone a final decision. Thank you.
Thanks, Torst. I think we've gone through the decision matrix earlier in the presentation, and there's a the reason it was called a final decision for those items that are listed as final decisions are the ones that require a different work stream. And so, you know, like you could view it as a recommendation as well. And like Brendan had mentioned, on this one in particular, we just received information last week that we need time to review further. And so we'll take the time to review that, and then we'll follow up with stakeholders on the next steps of the process for this item. I should also mention that I know it's been brought up that like we've gone through two rounds of stakeholder consultation. This is kind of the third round. And like we've heard from yourself, we've heard from TransAlta, and I think specifically on this matter, but there are other stakeholders that don't share the same opinion. So the ISO is taking into consideration, you know, the view of all stakeholders as we work through the recommendations and decisions and whatnot. I'll send it back to you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rupa. Thank you, Horst, for your feedback there. Just going to check here. Looks like we have a written Q&A here. A couple here I'm just going to go through. Joseph Van Ellenberg. His question is, how has the ISO satisfied itself enough with their proposal to move to a sealed bid format to provide it as a final decision without empirical analysis on the cost benefit impacts to the market, leveraging analyses that was done for the energy market, which does not resemble the OR market, is inadequate? So I think he has some comments on that. Anyone want to share a response there?
I can take that. I think we've explained in this session at a high level, as well as in previous sessions, why we don't believe that that empirical analysis would be feasible and or accurate enough in order to inform decision-making on this. We will be reviewing the expert report submitted by TransAlta. And so to the extent that there's empirical analysis in that, that we believe is helpful in informing these conclusions, then we would certainly be taking that into account. In terms of how we've made the decision, I think we have made it based on principles as well as findings in economic literature. And that includes basically an identification of the potential risks and the potential benefits. And we think that there are ways that we can facilitate an information-rich environment and achieve some of the benefits of open transparency while mitigating the potential risks that have been clearly identified in competition and auction theory literature.
Thank you, Brendan. I appreciate your response there. Okay. All right, we have one more raised hand here. Akira, I'm just going to allow you to ask your question here.
Yeah, I think this is actually a question, so I do appreciate that you are going to consider the report. That being said, on the pro rata component, you're suggesting that you're going to split based upon the amount of megawatts that were offered. So for instance, if one supplier is offering double the amount of megawatts that the other one is, they get double the amount of cleared offer. Is that correct?
Sorry, I wasn't more clear about that, Akira. Our proposal is that to the extent that there are marginal providers with the same price, that we would evenly distribute the required volume amongst those providers to the extent
so it's equivalently
that split. There is sufficient volume in their offer block.
Not pro rata split. In other words, because pro rata would be taking the amount of volume essentially that was put in and then using that as the scaling factor on which you split, rather than, for instance, if I have two suppliers, one supplier offering 100 and one supplier offering 50, and I only need 10, I split it. I get what I believe what you're saying is that you're going to give 5 to each.
It would be 5 to each. And so apologies that I wasn't more clear about that. And if you have feedback on one of those approaches versus the other.
Mine was just an understanding kind of clarification, just so that sure. When I do commenting on what your actual proposal is. Okay. Additionally to that, I just have another question. Like, if you're going to a sealed bid format, why does the time of anything getting submitted in become meaningful as a component to make a decision on?
So I agree. We heard from some participants that time becomes less relevant in a sealed format. We heard from other participants that said that they still thought that the time submitted was still a fair way to break ties. And so I think we agree that it becomes certainly less relevant in a sealed format than an open format. And that's why we would use this new.
I think more structurally, I don't understand the mechanics of what you're actually proposing is. And so is there a time difference? Like when you ask for those submissions to be made in, aren't they all coming in at the same time anyways? Like, I just don't know how you're actually even using time as a differentiator.
So the submission would still take place very similarly to how it currently does on the WadEx platform. So you would still have a 10-minute window to submit your offers. And so we're proposing that that would be used as a secondary tie break in the case that, for example, if we had 3 marginal providers and only 2 megawatts to divide, then the two offers that came in earlier would receive the 2 megawatts or 1 megawatt each. I think I understand from your feedback that perhaps there's some more clarity to provide on this, and I think we can provide that as part of the comment matrix to ensure that participants are understand what our proposal is when they're providing their feedback.
Yeah, I think that would be very, very helpful. And that, you know, ours were just about our criticisms, and I think that the LEOI was kind of talking about it at a high level. We don't even understand the true mechanics of what you're proposing, what it would look like. And so more description about that might actually unveil other things that would be a concern. But okay. Again, don't have an idea what you're really going with.
Okay, thank you for that feedback.
Thanks, Akira. Okay, I think we're cleared up here for questions. So I think we can jump into the next section.
All right, so the next section is minimum qualification and offer size. And so this is something that we've received relatively substantial comments on, both through this engagement as well as previously through the Distributed Energy Resources, or DER, consultation. However, there are still parts of this proposal that we're seeking feedback on, and so we'll outline those today. Just as another refresher, firstly, the minimum qualification size for regulating reserves is 15 megawatts, for spinning reserves is 10 megawatts, and for supplemental reserves is 5 megawatts. And the minimum offer size for all products is 5 megawatts. Also, dispatch tolerance is currently 1 megawatt for assets less than or equal to 20 megawatts, and 5% for assets that are greater than 20 megawatts. One thing not listed here that we want to talk about today is also directive tolerance for contingency reserves, and I will get to that in a following slide. The ISO's proposed alternative was to reduce the minimum qualification and offer size to 1 megawatt for all products to enable participation from new technologies and support increased competition, and also to move to a 5% dispatch tolerance for all assets. On the next slide. So the ISO, we do believe we've received comprehensive feedback on our draft recommendations, and so we want to thank stakeholders for that. There are 3 outstanding items that we want to get more feedback or to understand better. Firstly, participants requested some more details on the technical study that relates to our recommendations. Secondly, we heard continued concerns from some participants relating to directive practices for contingency reserves, and so we want to discuss some of those today. And finally, as I mentioned, we shared a recommendation on dispatch tolerance, but we did not share a recommendation on directive tolerance, and so we'd like to do that today as well. So to begin with, to share some more high-level summary information about our technical study, I'll be handing it over to Dan Wiebe, who is the Manager of Operations, Engineering, and Market Support.
Thanks. The ISO performed a technical study to investigate changing the size requirement for resources that provide regulating and spinning reserve. We've heard that market participants are interested in more information from the study. The study wasn't created for public release, so we have not shared the complete study, but I'm here today to share the scope, method, and results. The technical study was focused specifically on system frequency performance. The ISO developed a validated baseline model to simulate the system's frequency performance in the event of a trip of the inner ties using existing OR providers. We then simulated how the frequency response would change if existing providers were no longer participating and were replaced by smaller units of various sizes with similarly configured governors. The simulations showed that smaller assets can theoretically provide equally effective primary frequency response. We concluded that the ISO should not prevent smaller assets from providing reserve on the basis of frequency response. Next slide, please. Here we can see some simulation results from the study. On the left, we can see the validated baseline simulated frequency response. On the right, we can see three overlapping curves obtained from simulations where the existing providers are displaced by collections of 10 megawatt, 5 megawatt, and 1 megawatt assets, respectively, with the same aggregate capacity. The simulations show unit size does not necessarily have an adverse effect on primary frequency response. If the smaller units have governors with similar settings, such as droop, then the system's frequency response is practically the same. I think, Brendan, you can take it from here.
Thank you, Dan. I think on the next slide, 45. So I mentioned we want to discuss directive practices today. So in session two, we shared that we were initiating updates to directive practices in response to stakeholder feedback. And so today we can share some more information about that. So this update will establish a priority for directives, and that priority will be determined by ranking providers based on the time that has elapsed since their last directive. That time elapsed will only accrue when dispatched for contingency reserves, and that ensures fairness both for new and intermittent participants in contingency reserves. The update will also introduce the ability for system controllers to send directives to multiple assets with a single action, which will ensure that controllers can effectively use all qualified assets for reserves. However, system controllers will retain final discretion, and they may override this priority in unforeseen circumstances. And this update is scheduled to be deployed by early October 2022, so within the next month. The final thing that we want to discuss today is directive tolerance. So the tolerance for contingency reserve directives is currently specified over three time frames, between 0 and 10 minutes from receiving the directive, the asset must reach the directive quantity. Between the 10 and 15 minute mark from receiving the directive, the asset must maintain response that is equal to or greater than the directive quantity. And from 15 minutes onwards, for each 10 minute interval, the average response during that 10 minutes must equal the directive volume plus or minus 5 megawatts if the maximum capability is 200 megawatts or less of the asset, or 10 megawatts if the asset's maximum capability is greater than 200 megawatts. The current practice for directive tolerance beyond the 15 minute mark will not be effective for small assets. And the current practice also means that tolerance is materially different if your asset is just below or just above the 200 megawatt threshold. So the ISO's draft recommendation is to apply a directive tolerance of 5% of the maximum capability of the asset for assets that have a maximum capability of less than or equal to 200 megawatts, and 10 megawatts for assets that have a maximum capability of greater than 200 megawatts. This will ensure that effective response being able to be effectively monitored from small assets, and it'll also result in more consistent treatment of assets that are near the 200 megawatt threshold. So in summary, the current practice of minimum qualification sizes of 15 megawatts for regulating reserves, 10 megawatts for spinning reserves, and 5 megawatts for supplemental reserves. The ISO's proposed alternative is to move to a minimum qualification size of 1 megawatt for all products. And that is a final recommendation, which again, to clarify, means that we believe we've received comprehensive stakeholder feedback on this issue, and we will be progressing it through the AUC rules process. The minimum offer size is currently 5 megawatts for all products, and the ISO's final recommendation is to move to a minimum offer size of 1 megawatt for all products. Currently, SCADA is only required for assets that are greater than or equal to 5 megawatts, and so the ISO's final recommendation is to move to require SCADA for all assets that are providing OR, even if they are below the 5 megawatt threshold. Again, to ensure that we can monitor compliance and performance of these assets. The current practice of dispatch tolerance being 1 megawatt for a dispatch less than or equal to 20 megawatts and 5% for a dispatch greater than 20 megawatts. The ISO's final recommendation is to move to a dispatch tolerance of 5% of the dispatch volume for all assets. And finally, relating to directive volume, currently the directive tolerance of 5 megawatts for an asset MC that is less than or equal to 200 megawatts and 10 megawatts for an asset with an MC of greater than 200 megawatts. And the ISO's draft recommendation that we're seeking further feedback on is to move to a directive tolerance of 5% of maximum capability for an asset with an MC less than or equal to 200 megawatts and to retain a 10 megawatt directive tolerance for assets with a maximum capability of greater than 200 megawatts. And with that, we are happy to take more questions and comments on this topic.
Thanks, Brandon. So I was just going to hop over to the written Q&A here. And Ethan Natitian, it looks like Dan is messaging you an answer. For all other stakeholders, if you're wanting to see all the responded questions as well, if for anything that had a written response, just go show all and you should be able to view those questions in there.
Jennifer, I think I can take Ethan's question. Oh.
Perfect.
Sure. Thank you. So Ethan asked, is it reasonable to assume similar governor setups would be adequately achieved on smaller generating units? Has the ISO considered comparing historical performance of small generators to the modeled performance to ensure accuracy of the modeling? So first, I think it's reasonable to a large extent to expect similar performance because the governor configuration is governed by ISO rules. And if they performed poorly, that would just be a sign that the technical rules might need to be adjusted or to be more prescriptive. Generally, there can be a disparity for generators of all sizes between models and actual performance and historical events. So there is a possibility for difference there. But it exists for generators of all sizes, and when it exists, that would be something that would be dealt with through compliance.
Thanks for that, Dan. Okay, we have another question here from Andrea Thiessen. Will the ISO follow up to review how often the system controllers override the priority after the update is deployed?
So the ISO will want to review those events to understand the circumstances. I can say that we've looked to identify some of those circumstances internally, and I describe them as being unforeseen, and that's because we understand that contingency reserves are used in emergency conditions, and so we anticipate that in the vast majority of emergency conditions that system controllers would still follow the priority that's recommended by that queue. However, if there is a circumstance that required system controller discretion, then we'd want to take note of that and potentially adjust the process if required, or adjust the circumstances where system controllers might differ from the ranked priority.
Wonderful, thank you. So that addresses our written questions. I'm just going to hop over here with raised hands. We're going to go back to Akira on the lines if you can unmute. Maybe that didn't
unmuted me and not Akira. Was that on purpose?
He lowered his hand. Sorry, but you had yours as well. So
yeah, I'm happy to ask my question, but I was surprised because you said Akira. So
I did.
Anyway, it's Horst Klingborg with Suncor. The first question was, so the ISO is suggesting kind of percentages of 1 megawatt kind of qualified units. So are we going to see, like, I mean, do I understand this right? We're looking at kind of 0.2 megawatt of dispatch tolerances and things like that. Will we have kind of published data by the ISO? How confident is the ISO to have like adequate metering and information available to make this work? Because, yeah, whatever, I have a 3 megawatt unit at 5%, that's like 1.5 megawatt, 0.15 megawatts, I think, something like that, tolerance, or even less. So how is that going to work? Does the ISO feel confident, and are we going to get appropriate information where whatever the CSD page is updated to 2 decimals?
So I don't believe we're intending to update the CSD page to include decimals. However, the ISO has reviewed the feasibility of monitoring performance and compliance of these assets down to partial megawatt levels. And through that review, we concluded that the SCADA information that will be required from those participants has sufficient granularity in order to ensure that participants are meeting those partial megawatt directive tolerances down to the 1 megawatt asset size level.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for that question, Horst. So now, Akira, I'm going to go to you, if you can unmute on your end.
Thank you. Akira Yamamoto from TransAlta. I think this is a bit of a repeat because we've expressed our concerns with this minimum threshold. I do recognize that you've tried to allay some of our concerns with this study that has been done. It sounds like a fairly theoretical study, but at the same time, not something that you're willing to publish. I think that that starts to create some concern, because despite the fact that you're suggesting that these smaller units are equivalent performers in terms of practices and the way that you actually dispatch and direct units on in the OR market, it looks like something else is driving those decisions then, if it isn't technical performance. And I think there hasn't been enough done to explain why there is such a difference in large versus small providers and directive percentages. And if that is the case, I do think that you're actually creating two different products here, pretending that you can use the same pricing mechanism for both. And so I do oppose this change, but I do ask that the ISO present some information about how this difference has emerged in the ISO's practices. Because without any identification about what those root causes are, although you're suggesting that you made some tweaks here, I'm not sure that those tweaks are solving any of the problems that are creating that difference. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment, Akira. I think I can just briefly respond that we have heard your concerns related to directives, and I think we do agree that there is a potential for improvements related to that. And so that's what's motivated the changes that we've outlined here today. To the extent that there are differences that we see in, say, performance or compliance, even after the fact, after these directive changes go live, then that would be resolved through our compliance process. And if there are providers, for example, that aren't meeting the technical requirements, and that could result in penalties and potentially also reduced or completely eliminated qualification to participate in the OR market.
Thanks, Brandon. Great points there. So let's go over to Parag Menon. I'm going to unmute on your end, and if you can unmute yourself as well.
Thank you. I have two questions. So one's on slide 45, point two, where you're saying you can establish a priority for directive that ranks based on the time elapsed. So can you just please explain a little more in detail? So would it be that the participant who has had seen a last directive pretty soon, would they get a higher priority as compared to somebody else who was not earlier or who was not last directed for a very long time? Or is it the other way, where you might give the participant who was not less directed to give a more opportunity in terms of balancing the directive dispatches? So can you just explain how the priority would be established? And then the second point would be is I do understand that your proposed made changes that would elevate a little bit of the risk in terms of what the MSA report kind of had highlighted about the directive call dispatches that had given to large assets compared to smaller one, and you're making the changes. On my personal suggestion would have been that since you're implementing those changes in October, rather than doing a final decision, I would have rather waited to see what those changes would have an impact in terms of the directives and stuff, and then made a recommendation and then made a decision on the final. So
I think your latter comment there is noted, and thank you for that feedback. I think on your first question, if I understood properly, I think it would be the latter of the options that you described, in which the participant that most recently received a directive would have the lowest priority for receiving the next directive. Or in other words, if you think of it as a line or a queue, that the provider that most recently received a directive would go to the back of that line or the back of that queue. And then other participants for which their last directive was a longer time ago, they would have a higher priority, or they would be next in line, so to speak, to receive the directive.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that question. Okay, there is a couple of written questions here, so we'll just jump over to Akira's written. He asks, wouldn't the prudent approach be to have a clear demonstration that the directive rates are the same and then reconsider this recommendation? So we have any comments on that question?
I think the ISO rules application will be required to progress these changes. And so we will expect that the directive changes will have been in place for some time before that AUC process is concluded. And so there should be substantial information at that time before any lower qualification assets were to enter the market.
Thank you, Brendan. Okay, and one other question here. Oh, a couple. Can the ISO please explain why the aggregation approach shouldn't be the model for smaller unit participation?
I think our view on that is that it's really the reverse, in that if we required assets to aggregate if they're small, then we would need good rationale for that. And if our systems and if our internal ISO systems and if our controllers can make use of smaller assets, then we should be facilitating them entering the market. Based on our technical studies, based on our findings, and based on some of the adjustments that we're making to our market and practices in order to facilitate these assets, we think that we can create a level playing field for small assets and that they can be treated fairly compared to large assets. If small assets prefer to aggregate, they're welcome to do that. But we don't think that it makes sense to force any type of asset to aggregate if they don't need to in order to meet our requirements.
Excellent. Thank you. Another question here from Ethan Natition. Would participants who participate infrequently now be at risk of receiving a larger percentage of dispatch relative to their provided volume?
So the intent of having the time elapsed, so to speak, only accruing when you are dispatched for contingency reserves. Keeping in mind, again, that being dispatched for contingency reserves, meaning you're holding your capacity in reserve ready to respond to a directive. That means that, for example, pardon me, if an asset provided contingency reserves all the time versus another asset that, say, provided contingency reserve half the time or on alternating days, you'd expect on average, obviously this will change based on system conditions, but you would expect that on average, the asset that provides reserves all the time would receive twice as many directives as the asset that provides reserves half the time. And so by only monitoring or only accruing time in that counter, so to speak, when you're actually dispatched for providing reserves, it means that intermittent providers should be provided fairly or treated fairly compared to frequent providers.
Okay. Thank you for that. Moving on here, we have a question from Santi. He's asking, can the ISO please explain the merits supporting the proposed approach to ranking for directives?
I think we've heard concerns from a few stakeholders that large assets are being treated differently than small assets. And we think that it's important, especially if we're facilitating the entry of new small assets into the market, that we are maintaining a level playing field and that all assets providing the same product are subject to the same requirements and are providing the same product with the same level of quality. And so we think that making these changes to directives helps us to achieve that and helps to address some of the concerns that we've heard from stakeholders.
Okay, thank you for that. Paul Berry asks, what would trigger a review of the price cap of, say, the $11.50 for RR?
I think that we shared a number of indicators that we looked at in coming up with that number. And I think if we saw a change in those indicators, whether it's the persistence up against the offer cap, whether it's a change in the amount of entry into the OR market that we're observing or any of the other indicators we looked at, I think that could prompt us to review that.
Wonderful, thank you. Okay. Do we have a couple more minutes for a couple raised hands, or do we want to keep moving forward in the presentation at this time? How are we looking for time?
I think we're running a little late based on the agenda. Is that correct?
So maybe we can just skip into the next section. Does that work? Or
I think we did have a brief break scheduled here. Okay, I think
perfect.
I believe it was 10 minutes in the agenda, but perhaps we can pare that down a little bit. Maybe say 5 minutes just for a quick break and then move on at 10:55 if that works.
That works. We'll see you back then.
Okay. Thank you. I think I see, it looks like Horst has some questions that he's typed into the chat. I think just for time's sake, I think it's probably better to continue with the presentation for now. We're also intending to have an opportunity for questions and comments at the end of the presentation, time permitting. And so I think we can address some of those then. Although to the extent that some of those can be addressed with a written answer, I believe we might be able to get that to you. So the next topic is hourly procurement. So just as a quick refresher, the ISO currently procures operating reserves in 4 time blocks. That includes the on-peak and off-peak time blocks for all reserves. And then for regulating reserves only, we also procure AM super peak and PM super peak blocks that overlap the on and off peak blocks. And the ISO proposed alternative that we shared in the previous session was to move to hourly reserve procurement, with the idea that it may enable increased participation from some technologies, such as energy limited technologies like energy storage. I think we can go to slide 52. Thank you. So we did solicit some feedback on the high level idea of going to hourly procurement in session 2. And we saw that stakeholders were somewhat split. Some stakeholders preferred block procurement and others preferred hourly procurement. However, we feel that the nature of some comments suggested that the ISO was not clear about how hourly procurement would work, and that in particular, hourly procurement, as we're proposing it, would still be done on a day-ahead basis. So the only change is that in the day-ahead market, instead of the hours being grouped in blocks, participants would submit offers and we would procure reserves for each hour individually in the day-ahead market. So just to be clear, this would not be a movement to real-time reserve procurement. And we want to highlight that maximizing competition remains the focus of this initiative and this change in particular, and we believe that that's the best way to ensure efficient outcomes in the market. And so our priority in assessing or evaluating the differences between hourly and block procurement is really minimizing barriers to entry. Because we did have some participants that submitted that they would prefer or be able to participate better under hourly procurement, we did say that we could do some analysis of hourly procurement in that case. And so we did a counterfactual analysis of the procurement cost of contingency reserves under hourly versus block procurement. This was feasible for us because the volume requirements for contingency reserves are already calculated on an hourly basis, and the movement to block procurement is done before we actually submit volumes into the day-ahead market. We used operating reserve data from April 1st of last year to the end of March this year in order to capture a full year of data and any seasonal variability with the most recent offer volumes or procurement volumes, rather. And we estimated that by moving to hourly procurement, we would have cost savings of approximately $4.4 million. And these cost savings arose because the hourly approach allows for more flexible procurement, which more closely follows the actual load shape and system needs. And so under block procurement, there may be some hours where we've procured more reserve than we need as a result of the limitations of block procurement. We also looked into doing a similar analysis for regulating reserve, but we determined that this was likely not worth the undertaking, as the block definitions for regulating reserve are integrated into the study process that determines volume. And so if we were to move to hourly, that would require doing an entire technical study on new regulating reserve volumes. And we also believe that the cost savings associated with moving to hourly procurement for regulating reserves are likely smaller, as the super peak blocks that we procure already allow for a more granular procurement shape that follows our reserve needs a little more closely. And finally, we believe that the potential for cost savings with standby reserves is much smaller, as the activation price is only paid when the reserves are dispatched. So that means we more or less only use those reserves when they're needed. And therefore, the ISO proposes to continue procuring standby reserves in on-peak and off-peak blocks. Another decision item related to this is whether the day-ahead auction format will need to change at all. And so currently in the day-ahead market, the ISO procures reserves two blocks at a time in 10-minute increments, and that starts at 9 a.m. and goes through 10:10 a.m. But we're seeking feedback on whether the 10-minute interval would still be sufficient if participants need to submit offers for each hour individually rather than submitting offers for the blocks. So in summary, the current practice of procuring OR in the day-ahead market in AM superpeak, PM superpeak, on-peak, and off-peak blocks. We've proposed the alternative of moving to procurement of hourly reserves in the day-ahead market, but we would retain day-ahead block procurement for standby reserves. And we're seeking further feedback on the impact to competition and barriers to entry related to that proposal. And additionally, the current day-ahead format, we procure two blocks in each 10-minute window, and we would like to understand whether a longer duration or perhaps dividing the procurement into more intervals would be better in order to accommodate more the requirement for more offers for individual hours. And likewise, we're seeking further feedback needed before determining a preferred alternative. And with that, we can move to discussion in Q&A on this topic.
Great. Thanks, Brendan. All right, let's jump into some of these questions here from Horst. We have a first one here that's been upvoted. Does participants use the CSD page as part of their processes to ensure compliance? If the market moves to sub-megawatt compliance, better information would be useful. More of a comment, but anything you guys want to share on that?
I think that's a helpful comment, and we can certainly take that back and consider that. Thank you.
Thanks, Horst. Okay, next one. Number two from Horst. With a move to sub-megawatt compliance and the ability to direct multiple assets, why not simply direct pro rate to begin with instead of using this unique, quote, time since last directive list?
Just considering that now, having heard that, I think that would likely result in the same outcome over time, meaning that participants would receive proportionally the same amount of directives. I suspect there might be other considerations of having many participants responding to very small directives rather than having a smaller number of participants responding to a directive that is more likely to be their full volume. I think if there's more consideration that should be given to that, I think we're open to comments on that.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. One more from Horst with Klinkenberg with Suncor. Does the directive tolerance recommendation create a mismatch between energy market dispatch compliance and OR directive compliance?
So I believe that the current directive compliance is based on allowable dispatch variance for the energy market. And I think so it would be different from allowable dispatch variance. So I think the answer is yes to that question.
Great. We have a question here from Troy McTavish. So to confirm, the current approach to directives hasn't been a level playing field. That's a question though. Are you willing to publish the data that would support or deny that conclusion?
So I think what we're observing from participants is that there is room to improve. And so I think we are taking steps to do that. I think as many participants probably know in this engagement now, the MSA has published some statistics on directive rates between participants. And we think that those are useful and we've referred participants to that. And I think we'll continue to suggest that that's what participants use in informing their comments on this particular issue.
I'll just add a little bit to that as well. We also think that with the minimum size threshold being reduced, that there's a greater need to ensure that there's a process in place for directives.
Thank you both for that. Okay, one more from Horst at Suncor. Regarding compliance enforcement, Suncor has a concern about the current process being ineffective. While the penalties certainly provide some deterrence, something seems to be required to prevent frequent non-compliance. Suncor would appreciate some further discussion on this.
I think we can certainly note that and take that back. And we have heard some comments related to that within the stakeholder feedback matrices as well. And so we have taken those comments into consideration. And so we want to ensure that we're promoting compliance going forward. And so I think we have taken the comments from participants into consideration and will continue to do so going forward. But as part of the market design changes that we're contemplating as part of this initiative, I don't believe we're at this time considering any changes to the compliance mechanism.
Okay. Thank you, Brendan, for sharing that. So Paul Berry has a question here, but I'm not sure which slide it's regarding. It says 4.4 million per year savings. Do you guys have a?
I think that's in relation to the procurement shape analysis that we did. And so yes, that was a 4.4 million per year estimated savings on contingency reserves, based on the movement to hourly procurement instead of block procurement. However, I will note that there are some simplifying assumptions to that analysis. For example, we didn't change offer behavior of participants. So if offer behavior was to change in response to that, perhaps if assets were cycling more often, for example, that could potentially increase their offers and lower the cost savings. I'll also note that we did not re-clear the OR market, or in other words, we kept the OR price at what it originally cleared at. And so to the extent that we are procuring a smaller volume of reserves in a given instance, that may also lead to us going down the merit order and potentially reduce the price of operating reserves. And so that's an assumption that would directionally make our estimate conservative. But yes, on balance, we estimated 4.4 million per year.
Okay, thank you for that one. Randy Stebbings has another question here. As the volume of intermittent renewables increases, are you observing a decreasing differentiation in regulating reserve requirements between super peak and other hours?
I can speak to that at a high level. I'm not sure if anyone else might have more detailed information to speak to, but it's my understanding that changes in load in the super peak periods are still a major driver of requirements for regulating reserves. And so it still makes sense for us to have the greater volume at those times. However, certainly, as your question suggests, the presence of more renewables have also meant that we require or that regulating reserves play an important role at other times as well. So I'm not sure if I can provide any more detail than that, but that's my understanding of the topic.
Maybe I could add to that a little. Like, theoretically, yes, it would be expected that a larger share of variability comes from changes in non-dispatchable assets. And so that curve would flatten a bit for that reason. But I don't have any quantitative data to share with you about that today.
Okay, thank you both for that. Okay, I think we have a couple hands raised if we have a moment to jump over there. Ethan Attition, you want to unmute on your side?
Hey, not sure if you guys can hear me. Hopefully I'm coming through. Just a quick follow-up to Horst's question about prorated dispatches. And Brendan, your kind of follow-up, you talked about the added complication that it would induce, you know, given that there would be more assets being dispatched, but directed. Would that not naturally happen with smaller assets being included? Like, isn't this kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy? If there was 1 megawatt generators, there'd be the opportunity or the circumstances where there would be, you know, let's say 100 generators providing spinning reserve or something along those lines?
Yes, I think that having more small assets definitely would lead to situations where we have a higher number of assets responding to a directive. I think the suggestion to prorate directives would incrementally also increase that number. I don't think I meant to portray that as necessarily being a bad thing, but just a consideration in comparing the options. Again, just on the face of it, hearing that for the first time today, I think, you know, they're probably both options. I'm not sure of what, you know, a distinct benefit or disadvantage would be of the prorate option, but if people have something in mind, then I think we're open to hearing that.
Okay. Yeah, no, I appreciate the commentary. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ethan. Okay, I'm just going to go over to Akira Yamamoto, if you can unmute on your side.
Sorry, I didn't have a question. Apologies.
Oh, okay. No problem. So I think that is it. No open written Q&A, no raised hands, so we can move on to the next section.
Okay. So the next topic is contingency reserve procurement. And to be more specific, the interrelation of procurement of spinning reserves and supplemental reserves. So this is a topic that we shared some more information about in the previous session. Just again, a very quick background. So spinning and supplemental reserves, they're currently procured separately in different sequential auctions. However, they do have an interrelated function in that we're currently required to hold a minimum of 50% of our total contingency reserves as spinning reserves. And we do procure 50% of contingency reserves as spinning reserve. Although to meet our reliability standards, we could potentially procure more than 50% as spinning reserve. The ISO proposed in the previous session an option where volumes that were submitted into the spinning reserve procurement but did not clear, or in other words, were not accepted in the spinning reserve procurement, would move forward into the supplemental reserve procurement. This would retain the current sequential approach in the market, and participants would have the option to improve their position once they were in the sup market, so they could either increase the volume or lower the price, similar to how the activity rules work today for the lockdown period. And if you had a spinning reserve volume that was moved into the supplemental reserve procurement and was cleared as supplemental reserves, then it would be treated as supplemental reserves for the purposes of compliance and technical standards and those sorts of things. Next slide, please. So we stated that this could potentially reduce instances of price inversions between spinning reserves and supplemental reserves, and overall had the potential to reduce procurement costs. However, we also acknowledged that the case for change in this instance seems to be diminishing in recent years. And we heard from stakeholders that they agreed that the declining price inversions were reducing the justification. They also had concerns that the mechanism would add considerable complexity to the market, and that in this initiative, one of our objectives is to create simplicity where possible, and also that combined procurement, or in other words, taking spinning reserve volumes and moving them into the supplemental reserve procurement may undermine the may offer nature of the operating reserves framework. And so after considering that feedback, along with our own analysis on the topic, we decided to not pursue this change at this time, in response to stakeholder feedback. With that, I think we're happy to have any questions or comments on that topic.
Okay, we have a written question here from James O'Connor. Have you considered moving to a 24-hour procurement that... Have you considered moving to a 24-hour procurement may be overly complex for weekend sessions, as market participants will have to trade, track, and balance numerous price/volume pairs for 72 to 120 different trading windows in a 10-minute window?
Yes, I think we've considered that that would definitely be more complex. And so we are looking to hear from participants. If that complexity enables new participation in the market, perhaps it's worth it. But if we don't see that that complexity is going to translate into new entry and more competition, then it probably isn't worth it. We also think that there are potentially ways that we can structure the day ahead market in order to make it a little more practical in order to handle, you know, weekend sessions and that sort of thing. So I think perhaps a longer duration so that people have more than 10 minutes to submit their offers. That's one potential option. Also the way that the blocks are divided, so that we currently have two blocks per time period. There's potentially, if we're going to hourly procurement, there's a number of different ways that you could divide the hours across different procurements as well. And I think we're open to feedback on not only the change itself in terms of whether hourly or block procurement would maximize competition, but also what changes we might need to make in the market if we were to pursue hourly procurement.
Wonderful. Thank you. That's it for written right now. No raised hands, so I think we can move forward.
Okay. So the final topic today is standby reserve pricing. There is quite a bit to cover in this topic, but like all the others, happy to take any questions and comments once we get to the Q&A period. Just a quick overview again of the current practice related to pricing of standby reserves. So a reminder that we procure these reserves in order to meet our reserve requirements when the active portfolio is insufficient, and that the pricing structure has participants submit both a premium and an activation price to the WADEX platform. And then these prices are combined using a blended price formula to determine which offers clear the market. And that formula takes the premium plus the activation price, which is weighted by the activation percentage, to determine the blended price. That activation percentage is determined by the ISO based on historical activation rates. And participants that clear the market will be paid the premium when they are contracted for providing standby reserves. And if they receive a dispatch, they will also receive the activation price. And both the premium and the activation price are paid on a pay-as-bid basis. We shared two alternatives for pricing of standby reserves in session two. We received feedback on those alternatives, which was beneficial. And we then published a supplementary document along with the stakeholder invitation for this session on August 18th. And we're hopeful that that document can be used to aid stakeholders in providing their feedback in order to provide more clarity on the alternatives, which admittedly there is a lot to consider in comparing the different alternatives. In response to the stakeholder feedback that we received after session two, we've also decided to propose a third alternative. This feedback that we heard included more detail on the premium price and how that premium price reflects the costs of contracted standby reserves that have not yet been dispatched. And also we heard from some participants that while the current mechanism is admittedly complex, they felt that the complexity of that mechanism is required in order for the standby reserve pricing to reflect the economic fundamentals of the product. And so we've tried to capture that feedback in a third option. So on slide 62, I'll just briefly go over some of the terminology that we'll use. And this is the terminology that was used in the supplementary document. So firstly, if a participant has entered into a contract by successfully selling standby reserves in the day-ahead market, then they'll be referred to as contracted. If the ISO requires operating reserves from a contracted provider, then it will activate standby reserves by issuing a dispatch through the automated dispatch and messaging system, or ADAMS. And that provider will now refer to as being dispatched. And if the ISO requires real power from a reserve provider who's dispatched, then the ISO will issue a directive through ADAMS, and that provider is now directed. And so we'll be reviewing how the different options, how the price and compensation differs in these three states. So the first option, this is an option that we shared in session two, is to move to single part offers where participants only submit an activation price. And so the offer will include an activation price. A change will be that that activation price would be indexed to the energy pool price. So in that way, it'll be very similar to the price that is submitted for active operating reserves. The market would then be cleared on a uniform basis, which means that the marginal activation price index would set the price for all dispatched providers. And we would dispatch the market based on the lowest to highest activation price index offer. So we would establish a merit order of activation price submissions in the same manner that we do today. For contingency reserves, if you are a contracted provider, meaning that you cleared in the day ahead market, but you're not currently providing active operating reserve to the ISO, then there would be no payment for those providers who today would earn the premium. However, those participants may still participate and earn revenue in the energy market. And the same applies for regulating reserves. For a dispatched provider of contingency reserves, they would receive the uniform indexed activation price, which would be the activation price plus the energy pool price for each dispatched megawatt. And they would receive the uniform indexed activation price for regulating reserves as well, in addition to the pool price for any real power provided in the course of providing regulating reserves. And then if a contingency reserve provider receives a directive to flow energy, they would continue to receive this uniform indexed activation price, and they would also receive the pool price for the real power that they provide in response to the directive. Moving to option two, in this case, we still have a single part offer. However, instead of submitting an activation price, participants submit a premium price. That premium price would then also be cleared on a uniform pricing basis, which means that the marginal provider would set the premium price for all providers of standby reserves. And the dispatch mechanism that we have today, where we dispatch from lowest to highest activation price, would not work in this situation because participants are not submitting an activation price. So there are different ways that you might dispatch the market here, but our alternative that we're putting forward today is a rotation between contracted providers. And this would be similar to how we've suggested a rotation for directives for contingency reserves. And so in other words, you'll receive a dispatch to provide reserve based on the last or the time that's elapsed since the last time that you provided reserves or were dispatched for reserves. So if you are a contingency reserve provider under this option, when you're contracted during the relevant time block that you cleared for, you would receive the uniform premium for each contracted megawatt, and you may still participate in the energy market. And the same payment applies for regulating reserves as well. If you are dispatched under this option, you would continue to receive that premium for each contracted megawatt. And then in addition to that, you would receive the prevailing active reserve price. So that means that for the product that you're providing at the time you're providing it, you would receive whatever the activation or the active price is. So for example, if you were activated for providing spinning reserves during the on-peak block, you would be paid the prevailing active spinning reserve price for each dispatched megawatt. And so that includes the equilibrium price, or in the case that we're moving to marginal pricing, the marginal price for spinning reserves plus the energy pool price. For regulating reserves, you would also receive the premium and the activation price in the same way, although it's worth noting that the prevailing active reserve price for regulating reserves would be the higher of the either the on or off peak or the super peak block. So because regulating reserves have overlapping blocks, that means that there may be two prices for regulating reserve at the same time. If, for example, you're dispatched during a period that is both within the on-peak and the PM super-peak time, so you would, the prevailing reserve price in that case would be the higher of those two prices. And then for regulating reserves as a dispatched provider, you would also receive the pool price for any real power that you provided. And finally, for a directive of a contingency reserve provider, you would continue to receive the premium, you would continue to receive the prevailing active reserve price, and then you would receive the pool price for real power that you provided in response to the directive. And then the third option that we're introducing today, or some participants who may have seen this in the supplementary document that we published earlier, effectively this third option retains the standby pricing structure the way that it is today, except that the activation price becomes indexed to the energy pool price. So the offer still contains the premium price and the indexed activation price. We will retain the blended price mechanism in order to clear the market. And then participants will be paid the premium and the index activation price on a pay-as-bid basis the same way that we do today. The dispatch would continue to use the activation price to establish a merit order. And so we would dispatch from the lowest to highest activation price index. And then just to quickly go over the payment received in the different circumstances. As a contingency reserve provider who is contracted during the relevant time block, you would receive your premium on a pay-as-bid basis, and you may still participate in the energy market. A regulating reserve provider has the same contracted payment. As a dispatched contingency reserve provider, you would continue to receive the pay-as-bid premium, and you also receive the pay-as-bid indexed activation price. So again, that means you would have the activation price plus the energy pool price for all of your dispatched volume. And the same applies to regulating reserve, except that you also receive the pool price for the real power that you've provided. And as a directed contingency reserve provider, you would continue to receive the pay-as-bid premium and the pay-as-bid indexed activation price, and then you would also earn the pool price for the real power that you provided. Of note, under options 1 and 3, the activation price becomes indexed to the energy pool price. And so we believe that it's appropriate to use the same ISO bid offer cap that is applied to the active reserve market. And so we've recommended caps of $150 per megawatt hour for regulating reserve and $50 per megawatt hour for both types of contingency reserve. And so we would apply those to standby activation index prices. And again, just for comparison to other jurisdictions, after including the maximum potential energy price, that results in effective price caps of $1,150 per megawatt hour for regulating reserves and $1,050 per megawatt hour for contingency reserves. Additionally, in options 2 and 3, where there's still a premium payment, the current price cap for the premium is $99 per megawatt hour, and we're proposing to keep that in place. And so at a high level, just in comparing the different options, we think that there are some key differences that we wanted to pull out of the kind of complexity of the different options. So with option 1, where you have a single part price with an indexed activation price, we think that this design, it very closely mirrors the active reserve market. And so it has reduced complexity. It uses uniform pricing, and it indexes the activation price in order to account for the opportunity cost of providing reserves. In this option, however, there's no opportunity for a payment for being contracted but not dispatched. And we heard from some participants in their feedback that that payment is important in order to reflect costs associated with providing those reserves. Under option 2, where we have single part pricing with only a premium price, it has similar benefits in that there's reduced complexity. It uses a uniform pricing mechanism and the activation price is indexed because it uses the prevailing active reserve price. However, in this option, there's no flexibility in the activation payment. So it means that you're subject to whatever the active reserve price is at that time. However, I'll just note that in the sequential clearing in the day ahead market, participants will know the active marginal price before submitting their standby offers, which means that they, to the extent that they desire a higher or lower total price, they could to some extent reflect that in the offer for their premium. And also we would require a new determining order for dispatches for reserves, as there's no longer an activation price offer with which to rank providers. And finally, with option 3 that we're proposing for the first time in this session, this again effectively retains the structure of the current pricing framework, except that we index the activation price to the energy pool price in order to account for opportunity cost. So this would be the most similar to the current practice. And so for those participants who we heard value stability, and believe that the current mechanism is effective, they may prefer this option. This also gives the maximum flexibility in the offer you submit, in that you have discretion over both the premium and the activation price that you're submitting. And it still has the benefit of having the indexed activation price so that the opportunity cost in the energy market can be reflected. The downsides to this mechanism are that it is somewhat complex, although some participants have suggested that complexity is not really an issue, as OR providers are sophisticated and they're familiar with the current mechanism. And also, this would effectively require us to retain a pay-as-bid mechanism. Some participants asked about more information about the considerations for uniform pricing and pay-as-bid formats in auction design. And so I believe on the next slide, I go into that briefly. So here I have an excerpt from a paper on the considerations for pay-as-bid versus uniform pricing. There is a variety of literature out there on this subject. So if participants are interested, there is more than just this paper. However, if they want to see more information from this source, it has been linked here. I won't read the whole thing, but the premise is that if you are in a pay-as-bid structure, you know that the highest price you will earn is just the price that you submitted, and there's no opportunity to earn a price higher than that if you are inframarginal, or in other words, if there are other people with higher prices that cleared the market. And so because of that, it creates an incentive for participants to try to estimate where the market is going to clear and to adjust their bid, or their offer in this case, so that it comes just below where the market clears. And this results in the offers from many participants being a lot more similar under a pay-as-bid format as under a uniform pricing format. And so the way they put it here is that the supplier's bid has as much to do with its guess about the clearing price and little to do with its cost. And as a result, dispatch inefficiencies are much more common under pay-as-bid pricing than under uniform pricing. And so in assessing the different options, while uniform pricing can be more efficient, there are other considerations, and so it's just a matter of weighting those considerations against each other. So to summarize, the current practice uses the two-part pricing mechanism described earlier that includes both the premium and activation price that are weighted using the blended price formula. We've proposed three options now that were outlined earlier, and for more information on those options, I recommend that participants have a look at the supplementary document that we published. And we don't have a preferred alternative yet, and we're seeking new feedback, especially given that we've now proposed this third option that was not mentioned in the previous session. We think the other thing to collect feedback on is relating to the offer cap for activation prices. And so our suggestion is that with the indexing of activation to the energy market, it provides a similar rationale for implementing an offer cap. And we think that using the offer caps for the active market that we've proposed of $150 per megawatt hour for regulating reserve and $50 per megawatt hour for contingency reserve would be appropriate. But we're also seeking feedback on that. And with that, I think we're happy to take any questions or comments on standby reserve pricing.
Great. Thank you, Brendan. So we've got a couple written Q&A that I can jump into first. Ethan Natishan has a kind of a scenario question here. He writes, if ISO were to index the standby price to the active price, is there a risk that there would be insufficient participation in standby markets? For example, if a group of assets set the active product price at a very large discount, it seems feasible that there may be no price at which would be sufficient to incentivize other generators to sell into the standby market. Would this risk ancillary procurement and ultimately reliability? And he has a bit of an example here as well. I'm not sure if you want me to read into that or if you want to.
I've pulled up the question here, so I think I can just have a quick look at the example.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think we've certainly considered the circumstance that you're raising, and I think that that is a potential downside of that option two, is that participants don't have the flexibility to reflect their own activation price offer because they are subject to whatever the active price is. I think something that partially mitigates that is that all participants will see that, for example, in your scenario here, that there's a negative $500 active price. And I think that they can use that information to inform their offer for the premium. I acknowledge that I don't think that perfectly solves the problem that you're talking about, but I think it's at least a partial mitigation. But I think that remains a downside of that scenario. And so really in which option you prefer, I think is a weighting of the consideration of scenarios like you've mentioned here with some of the other considerations, such as the ones that I highlighted in the kind of high level pros and cons table.
Thank you for taking that one. We have another question from Akira. He asks, why is paid as cleared a recommendation in active, but in standby it is paid as bid?
I think generally where it's feasible, I think we prefer uniform or pay as cleared formats. The reason that standby is pay as bid is because of the blended price formula, that participants have the flexibility between the activation price and the premium, and they can weight those things themselves. And for example, if we had a participant clear the market with a very high activation price and say little to no premium versus another provider with different cost fundamentals who had a very high premium price and a very low activation price, it wouldn't make economic sense to then clear the market where we're paying all providers both a very high activation price and a very high premium price. And so that more or less necessitates the need of a pay-as-bid structure if we have the blended price formula, which I think we've acknowledged is a downside of this the current practice, as well as this third option that we've suggested here. And so, again, it sort of comes down to weighing that consideration against, for example, the scenario that Ethan brought up earlier, along with some of the other considerations of the options.
Thank you, Brendan. So that is it for written Q&A. I think we have one raised hand over here. Horst, jumping over to you, if you can unmute on your side.
Thank you. I wanted to comment on the three options. I mean, I think my comment on the offer cap has been kind of heard loud and clear. I would say option three seems like an odd duck because all the concerns that were expressed with the current process seems to be more or less the same in option three. So that almost seems like a change for change's sake. So I'm not sure why kind of this was included. With option one, I have a concern because participants would potentially providing a service and not getting paid for days, weeks on end because there is no premium and you can only get paid when there's an activation. And even that could then still be zero depending on the pool price. So that doesn't seem like a rational option either, which leaves option two, which I think is the one that makes the most sense. I think Ethan's concern can be easily addressed with making sure that there's no offer cap on the premium, because then I can balance out every index activation price there is. There is a concern though with option two, and I'm wondering if you had thought about that, and that is with regard to your earlier recommendation on hourly clearing of the market, but not moving standby to hourly, because you would have 24 different activation indices, but only one chance to offer a premium that allows you to sell that entire shape, where in the active market you had the option of kind of going into individual hours. So there seems to be a mismatch, and I mean, given that I didn't really see the justification for the hourly to begin with, I would say there's a good reason to not kind of move to the hourly to make sure that you can also kind of move to option two here, because I think otherwise you can't.
I think all those comments are very helpful and we'll want to consider them. And I hope that we'll see comments along those lines within the comment matrix as well. I think the first point you made about the third option and how it doesn't address some of the issues with the current pricing structure, I think primarily the issues that it doesn't address are the complexity. And we heard kind of mixed signals from participants on whether that complexity is so complex that it warrants being an issue or not. And so I think we're interested in more feedback on that, but we have seen, you know, even relatively small or new entrant participants provide standby at times. And so perhaps the severity of the complexity is not a major consideration. I think the uniform versus pay as bid is definitely a potential issue, as we sort of outlined here. But in terms of the extent to which we think that that is distortionary versus some of the downside in, for example, that option two, that, you know, there it can create issues where you can somewhat reflect the activation price result in your premium. I think really there could be differing and valid opinions on which one of those creates the bigger issue or which one of those is most worth addressing. And so I think that's why we're seeking feedback on the different options. And the reason the option three is on the table is just because I think it most closely aligns with some of the perspectives that we heard in the stakeholder feedback.
Great. Thank you, Horst and Brendan, on that. I think we are good now to move on to the next section.
All right, this is me.
Yes, welcome, Jackie. She'll be taking us through this section.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jackie Gao. I'm the legal manager for ISO Rules and Alberta Reliability Standards at the ISO. We can move to the next slide, Jen. But before we jump into next steps, I just want to circle back on some of the earlier comments around governance. As Rupert and Miranda went over earlier, OR market implementation is spread across ISO rules, the contract, as well as a system platform. So where the ISO has discretion for some implementation decisions, those decisions are made by the ISO executive. And sometimes they do go all the way up to the ISO board. So I just want to emphasize that those decisions aren't made in a vacuum. They're informed by analysis, as well as insight and input from stakeholders. And I think most importantly, those discretionary items need to be made in accordance with the ISO's mandate. So to date on this initiative, stakeholders have provided some really great feedback to us. Some have expressed support for design items that others are not in support of. We've also received a lot of great comments today to consider for further market design discussions, as well as consultation on ISO rule changes. So in a nutshell, I think I just want to say that this isn't the end of the conversation. We've got more work to do, and we really appreciate everyone's continued involvement as we go forward. We are committing to some further process on some items, including the sealed bid auction format. We just need to take some time to figure out what that extra process looks like. And once we do that, we'll provide a more detailed account of next steps to everybody. So I guess the slide is a little bit outdated, considering some recent developments. Jen, if you want to move to the next slide. We also have our AUC Rule 17 development process for ISO rule amendments coming up as well, too. Because there is a lot on the regulatory calendar for the remainder of the year, we're still in the process of determining an optimal schedule for kicking off rule development. But once we do, this group will obviously be the first to know. We just want to make sure that we are not stacking things all at the same time as some other initiatives out there. We can move to the next slide too. This is just, again, some implementation facts. Our current thinking is that implementation of some certain items would be scheduled throughout 2023. Obviously, we will take that into reconsideration, considering some requests for further consultation on items. At current time, we anticipate that the cost of total implementation will be around the $1 million mark, again, to be confirmed. As the next bullet says, like, well, a more precise estimate will just depend on where we land in final decisions.
Thanks, Jackie. And just in closing, as you know, Jackie kind of built upon, we've gone through a number of changes that are in different stages of the consultation. And as noted previously, the topics presented are incremental change to support an efficient market design. We also recognize that bigger changes are coming in the future, and pursuing these changes now will help us evaluate the need for new products over the coming years, because we will have confidence that the existing market is functioning as well as it can. As you've also seen throughout today's session, in some areas, we have adjusted a recommendation or requested additional input from stakeholders to ensure we have a comprehensive review of the topic. And just to build upon that, we'll be publishing a stakeholder comment matrix following the session in the next couple of days. And, you know, we'd like to reiterate that we would like to thank you for all your continued participation in this initiative, and we welcome your feedback. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. So just going to check here.
All right. I see there's a written comment from Akira that I was writing a response to, but I may as well just respond verbally. So the implementation estimate came from our ISO systems team. Obviously not all of these designs are finalized. And so, for example, the options for standby reserves are not all finalized. However, that $1 million or less estimate basically came from an assessment of the system changes that would be associated with each of them. I don't want to presume what people think, but I do think that it's probably reasonable to say that that's a fairly low estimate, or it may sound low, but I would remind that part of the process that identified the changes that are within scope in this initiative to begin with was those changes that, in consulting with our systems teams, seemed relatively straightforward to implement within our existing systems. And so that's why we think that most of the changes here can be accommodated with sort of minimal updates or large scale changes to our infrastructure and supporting systems.
Okay, thank you. Rupa, do you have anything else to add to that? Oh, you're good? Okay.
I think I'm good.
Okay, perfect.
Do we have any additional questions?
Yeah, we had another raised hand here. We're just going to check back in with Horst. I'm going to unmute you, and you can unmute yourself.
Hi, thank you. Regarding kind of the process going forward, my big concern is around items that you've identified as being kind of final decision, because the way I read it, you believe that you can make these changes without changing rules. So do you have any idea or envision any process how participants can ensure some kind of oversight, official process similar to the AUC rule process, where participants can object if they believe that the rules don't meet the standard. Similarly, if these elements that you identified don't require rule changes, if we believe they don't meet FIR criteria or are in the public interest, is there some kind of process we can follow? What do you envision there, or how do you think we should deal with that?
Thanks, Horst. That's a great question. You're very familiar with our AUC Rule 17 process. We discuss the amendments to ISO rules or requirements for new rules that we believe are required to implement market design pieces. So there's more conversation around that. What's in the rules currently? What needs to change? What we may need to see in the rules going forward? So again, that's where more to come, I think, on through the rule development process about what's in rules and what's outside of rules. We're committed to continuing the conversation in that realm. In terms of stuff that is within the ISO's discretion, you know, there are elements of OR market implementation, like I said, are, and I just say we can talk further about that through the other processes that we set up to finish the work on this initiative.
Thank you, Jackie, for that. So it looks like we are good as far as hands raised, no outstanding Q&As. So I think we're good to wrap up. Thanks, everyone, for your participation. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to connecting with you again.